remind you, some of you are old enough to remember the days of the standardization of Common Lisp, and like a kitchen sink, it just managed to grow. And by the time the specification came out, it was over 1,400 pages. So that is one of the largest specifications for computer science languages. At the other extreme was a language that was intended to be small and simple, and that specification was 50 pages, Scheme. There's good sides and bad sides to both of that. And we have with us Dr. Michael Sperber today. He's going to explain to us how one of the bad sides of the low end, it was small because it was difficult to get consensus on growing it. And yet the large language is specified large enough so that you have a full-flavored, flexible language that's reasonably specified, especially if you have a good editor. So there's so much to be said here about the social evolution of a language that it takes to get a full specification, which one gets right. I would love to have asked Christian Connect, you know, just exactly, did you take protocols? How did you know where the right things were working? Where was the quality control? It was an enormous piece of work there. It was amazing. There's more to computer science than computer science. And we're going to find that, too, with standardization. So we have a little computer success here. We will... The answer is yes. We'll find out what happened with RSR6, why it happened, and why it's a good thing. I give you that, Michael Sperber.
Thank you. So, good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
let's see why.
So, I've never been to this conference before, so I have to introduce myself, usually. And the typical response I get is when I say I'm working on Scheme is, oh, you're one of those. So, I mean, there's Christian, there's Manuel, so I guess that makes us officially the exotic entertainment section of this conference. So, however, I work on Scheme, which will replace Common Lisp any day now. and the rest of it, you know, very soon afterwards. So, not just that, I'm here to talk about Scheme standardization. And for everyone here who's been involved in language standardization and language design standardization, you know It's this wonderful activity, right? It's friendly. You're likely to make new friends. Welcome everywhere, and there's this peaceful, warm feeling. So I decided to make a last minute change to the title of this talk. So I'm the project editor. So I do the LaTeX is sort of my job for it. For the standard, but in fact, I'm sort of a stand-in here for my co-editors, Will Klinger, Kent Dittvig, Matthew Flatt, and Anton van Straten. And we'll talk about warm, fuzzy feelings, but being involved in R6RS in the next revision of Scheme Standard has been the hardest thing I've ever done by far, and also the most painful thing, except maybe breaking up with my first girlfriend. So it's been a lot of work. It's been very difficult. We've had to go through a lot of contortions, I think, every one of us. A lot of fighting and struggling involved, a lot of uphill battles. And we'll see if it's worth it at the end of it, because we're not quite there yet. So I'm a member of the standardization committee, but here tonight, I'm only speaking for myself. So anything I might say to you about how Scheme is going to turn out might be, you know, we might vote some other way tomorrow. So this is my guess as to how it's going to turn out. So that's important disclaimer. So anyway, but if and when R6RS comes out, the next revision of the Scheme standard, then there will finally be something new in Scheme, which is that you'll be able to write useful portable programs in Scheme, right? Which, you know, many of you don't think that's such a great deal, but it's a big deal for the Scheme community. So here's an example for maybe a little real-world Scheme program that might be enabled by the next revision of the Scheme standard, which is sort of the equivalent of the Unix. Cat Utility, it's a program that imports the R6RS base library, the I/O library with the ports from R6RS, And well, if you look further down, you can see that it reads all the bytes from a file and outputs all the bytes from that file onto the standard output port. So this is something that will work, and that's something you couldn't do before. Not only will you be able to write substantial R6RS programs, but you will also be able to write reusable components of scheme code, so-called libraries. Here you can see an example library that provides a little functionality for two-dimensional points and being able to move these points. You can see that there, at the top, there's a declaration that this is a library called ILC points. It exports a couple of procedures in this case, make point, point P, point X, point Y, move point. It imports a few libraries to do its job. It defines a record type, big deal for scheme, and it defines an operation on that record type. So the details aren't particularly important, just to give you a very rough bird's eye overview of what you might be able to do. So, well, some of you I've heard haven't been following the process of scheme standardization for a while, so I'll just give you a rundown of what it's been like the past couple of years. R5RS, as many of you know, the last revision came out in 1998, but in fact all the decisions that were incorporated in the document were made at a meeting that had occurred in 1992, so it took 6 years just for the document to get written. But R5RS coming out was a big stepping stone to make progress. And right then in that year, we had a post-standardization workshop where a lot of ideas about future directions for standardization were circulated. And one of the results of that workshop was that we started the SERFI process, which was supposed to be sort of a complement to the revised report series, where every decision had to be made unanimously. On the other hand, there's a SERFI process which allows people to propose extensions to the scheme standard, and nobody has to agree by yourself. And so far, we're getting pretty close to 100 SERFIs by now. So that's still an ongoing process. So 1998 also sort of marked the relaunch of the Scheme Workshop series, mostly co-located with the ICFP conference. And in 2002, what we call a strategy committee was formed. And things moved slowly, right? So we had to form a committee to talk about what the committee was going to be like. And that was the strategy committee, and that worked for a year. And finally, in 2003, the Scheme community decided at a workshop, or at least those who were at the workshop decided that they were going to restart the Scheme standardization process and form an editor's committee for R6RS, and we've been at it since then, since the beginning of 2004, basically. Right now, in 2006, last year, we produced the first draft of R6RS, so you can actually look at it. It's right now it's in public review, so there's still a number of questions to be settled. And if you look at, we've actually set up a domain, r6rs.org, there's a web page, and you can get involved in the public review process. But I have to tell you, it's drawing to a close, so if you want to get your opinion in, then you should probably look at, and you haven't done that before, you should probably look at r6rs.org right now. And so hopefully in 2007, after the end of the public review pre-period, we'll actually see R6RS. Right now we're very close to 5.93 out of 6. So one notable change as compared to R5RS is that there won't just be one document, but instead there will be two. So there will be one document describing what we call the base library, which roughly corresponds to what was R5RS before, and then there's a whole bunch of standard libraries which are described in a separate document. And you can see the headers look pretty similar, but there's two separate documents. And when we're done, hopefully, we'll also have a document containing some non-normative appendices, some suggestions for operating specific things and stuff like that. And we'll also have a rationale document. The appendices are almost done. The rationale is still in the works. So over previous revisions of the scheme standard, there's a couple of new goals that we added in the process. I think the most important goal is probably that we really want to be able to write substantial portable programs in Scheme. And there's a couple of slightly smaller goals, like hygiene-breaking macros. We want to be able to define new unique data types. We wanted Scheme program. So if you look at the Scheme standard at R5RS Close, you'll see that there's not really a notion of type safety in the standard, even though many people believe that there is. And we wanted to fix that for the next revision. And we also wanted to enable efficient code, which, as far as what was an R5RS was concerned required a few tweaks to the language. If you look at the standard, there's a number of highlights that came out of trying to fulfill those requirements. Among them, libraries, which is sort of our name for modules, and I'll explain later why we chose a different name. There's a notion of programs. We now require the full numerical tower to be implemented, which we didn't before. The text representation now supports Unicode. We have an exception system. We have a serious I/O system. We've got binary data. We've got hash tables. We've got syntax case macros to enable the hygiene-breaking macros. We're replacing the denotational semantics that was in R5RS by an executable operational semantics. And there's many, many, many more details and stuff in there. So that's just a partial list of maybe the most visible stuff. One thing, if you're reading the documents, you might expect that now that the language or what's in the standard is structured as a bunch of libraries, is that these libraries aren't layered. It's not that the base library is exactly the stuff needed to implement the other libraries. And so that might be confusing to you. Instead, the libraries are organized according to what we believe common usage will be, right? So there's stuff that you can't implement in terms of the base library and some of the more specialized libraries, for example, the hash tables or the exception system. And so you might have a bunch of libraries that you're writing, my library, your library, Lisa's library, and Fred's library. We expect basically all of them to depend on the R6RS base library. And then some will use record, some will not use record, some will use I/O, some won't, some will use the R5RS compatibility library, and so on. So that's just a notice that when you read the standard, that you don't get confused by that. There's also a composite library that includes most of the libraries that we have in the standard, but we're sort of orphaning a very, very select set of them. We had a long debate over whether we should eliminate the mutation of pairs. Also, more recently, whether we should eliminate mutable strings. And also, there's eval, and ultimately, we want to phase out the stuff that's in the R5RS compatibility library. So those aren't in the composite library, and that's sort of a signal that they might be deprecated at some point in the future. They aren't quite yet. But I want to talk about a few of the, you can read about all the technical details of the standardization, the document itself, but I want to talk about a few things that were interesting in terms of the process and that maybe highlight what the standardization process was about and what was difficult. One of them was really about trying to get this portability aspect, right? And then there's some of the obvious features like records and libraries and Unicode. So we're talking about portability. We weren't really specific about whether we just wanted to allow people to write portable code or to what extent we wanted to force people to write portable code or to encourage them or whatever, where it would be on that spectrum. So if you want people to be able to write substantial portable code, then you've got to give them more than was in R5RS. So maybe that's the most important thing is to put more stuff in the standard. Also, I think the foremost thing that people wanted was to have a sufficiently powerful library system, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. And we also decided, through a pretty long and laborious process, that we really wanted, to some extent, to force people to write portable code, or at least to force them to explicitly mark non-portable code. So we're doing a lot to sort of catch cases of non-portability, but not everywhere. And I think it took us a while to realize that there's this tension between portability, but also between portability on the one side, but also about implementation strategies on the other side, about things like program readability and extensibility. Do you want to allow sort of implicit extensions where you extend the domain of a built-in procedure, or do you want to force people to put those extensions into separate libraries? And mostly, we really pin down the domains of procedures, but not in all cases. So here's, of course, we get caught up in the details, right? And one thing that we got caught up on was, well, sometimes you have expressions that don't sort of have a natural return value, that just perform a side effect, such as display, which is outputs something to whatever, the standard output port. And R5RS says, well, display returns a single value, but we're not going to tell you what it is. That value is unspecified, but it returns that single value. So you could write code like the code above that, well, it doesn't really do anything with a value returned by display, but it assumes that there is a single value being returned. Okay? So there's, so, but generally, we, I mean, there's a purpose to it not being specified in R5RS is in that people back with back before R6RS, people didn't want people to make any assumptions about that value, write programs that, well, we just had it with a programming contest, so that somehow depend on that value. So in principle, you could write an implementation that returns a different value every time. For the first revision, actually the first two revisions of R6RS, for various reasons we decided, well, we really, to encourage portability, we really need to pin down what that value is. And we decided to introduce a value called the unspecified value. And that was, we thought it was a neat idea at the time, but a lot of the community members didn't. And so with the next revision that isn't quite out yet, we'll swing the other direction, and it'll not just say it'll return an unspecified value, but it'll return an unspecified number of unspecified values. So that enables, and so you get the idea, and there's this tension, because for some implementation strategies of Scheme, it's very difficult to really enforce that the number of values always matches the number of values that are expected. There's the readability aspect, but at least this change enables Scheme implementations to go sort of into an anal mode where zero values are returned, and therefore nobody can do anything with that value. So maybe some future revision of the standard will pin this stuff down. But so even though we wanted to encourage portability, there's still some areas where there's some degree of unspecifiedness in the report. There's still, the evaluation order is still unspecified for similar reasons. Also the evaluation order with LetRec, that also has something to do with possible optimizations that a compiler might do. As I said, the return value of side effects, and also the matching up of multiple values being returned to a continuation that implicitly expects a single value, as in this case. So those are all tricky questions. So that was portability. Records. So I think it's very obvious to everyone in just about any community, especially the Scheme community, that we finally need one record syntax. We need one syntax for defining new record types. The problem is, if you look at the implementation landscape, there are a lot of Scheme implementations, and you'll have a lot of trouble finding two that have the same record syntax. In fact, a number of the systems in that list have two or three in the same system. Okay. So, I mean, it's a nice goal, but it won't. I have very little hope that it'll actually work out that way. So, well, we tried our best anyway. But the thing about record, also interesting if you look at the process, is that everything that factored into the current records proposal that will be in R6RS was known in the 1980s, literally. So I just a couple of weeks ago, I read up on the discussion that happened on the RRS authors mailing list. In the 1980s, everything was known that we talked about for R6RS. Pavel Curtis wrote a proposal in 1998, had basically most of the stuff that we talked about. SURFI 9 has been pretty widespread, one of the SURFIs, Richard Kelsey's, but it didn't have all of the stuff that we felt should be requirements, things like single inheritance, optional opacity, sealedness. We also wanted the ability to name everything, so that you don't have to depend on the system naming things in a funny way that doesn't agree with the way you want them named. And we also wanted custom modular constructors, modular in the sense that they're modular with respect to the inheritance relation. And that's actually pretty tricky, as it turned out. So again, I'll refer you to the document draft for the technical details, but the way it plays out right now is that the records actually come in three parts, or sort of three and a half parts. One is a procedural layer, which allows you to talk about record types and accessors and constructors separately, just using procedures. There's an inspection layer, there's an inspection library that goes with that allows you to extract the record type from a record if that record allows that. And then there's a syntactic layer, which is sitting in a separate library layer on top of the procedure layer. And actually, even that syntactic layer is sort of split into halves, because there's one sort of built-in layer that names things for you implicitly if you want, and that transforms into a more primitive version of the syntactic layer. So, well, that was maybe a bit complicated, but you'll see it if you look at it. But the idea is that at least the procedural layer will be a good basis for maybe different syntaxes to build on. And we hope that our own syntax will also catch on, but I'm sure that some people will still feel the need to have their own syntax and at least be able to build upon that common layer. So here's sort of the shortest way you can write a point record type. You just say define record type point, and you say it's got two fields, x and y. And the way the layering works out is that I've replicated that form at the top, is it expands a little bit further and telling you, oh, okay, we're defining a record type called point. It has two fields. Because the abbreviation means that they're immutable, this is now being made explicit in the second form. And that expands into the form at the bottom where everything is named explicitly. You can see that so that from the name of the fields and the name of the record type itself, the implicit naming layer will derive the name of the constructor, of the predicate, of the accessors, and so on. But you can name all of those things explicitly, and that was pretty important to some of us because it enables, for example, enables you to grep for names. And that's sometimes important. And then, again, that syntactic form expands into a bunch of definitions that are based on the procedural layer. So that's that. Records. So everybody agreed that we really needed records for R6RS, and that's the solution that we came up with. The thing that really everybody wanted was, everybody told us, you need to come up with a module system. If you don't come up with anything else, you need to come up with a module system. And they would say something like, you don't have to spend a lot of time on it. Just pick a simple one. Pick any old simple module system, and it'll be fine. Better than nothing. And this turned out to be very, very difficult, not just sort of politically, procedurally, but also technically. And so at one of the physical meetings that we have, we actually sat down and decided to write possible requirements, things that people might want to do with a module system on the blackboard. And I don't have a photo of the original board, but Manuel, you were there. It looked like this, right? It was full, right? It was full. So it was very difficult to in designing a module system that would have fulfilled all the possible requirements. Would have been very difficult. So we really needed to decide on a set of requirements, and that was sort of compounded by the fact that, again, as with the records, many scheme systems come with module systems, but no two are alike, even though they look superficially very similar. And I think that was part of the reason why many people were sort of expecting that just picking any old module system wouldn't be so hard, or just coming up with some kind of agreement. So, for example, there's the Big Blue module system. So I just have the same example for several scheme implementations to give you an idea of how superficially similar module systems might be actually very different at the core. So the idea is that you have a module M1 that defines two identifiers foo and var. Both are exported, and they're imported by a second module M2. And that just defines some identifier bas, which is supposed to be the sum of the two. So in the Big Blue module system, you can see that there's a module declaration. It tells you the names of the exported identifiers, and then there's a bunch of definitions. And you might also have imports in the case of M2, and so you might have an additional import clause in your module form. So you have a module form, you have imports and exports. That sounds easy enough. The Shea scheme looks pretty similar. There's a module form. It doesn't say export explicitly, but foo and var up there are the exports of the module. So it's just a keyword that's missing. So you say define foo, define var, module M2 exports bas and imports M1, and it's just the same thing. So it's, except for a couple of parentheses in the export keyword, it looks pretty similar. MIS scheme, another scheme implementation, again, it looks very similar. Again, you have a form called module. You have, for MIS scheme, you need to specify the language that you start with. So that's why it says MIS scheme right at the top. It doesn't say import and export, it says provide and require, but again, it looks very similar, you'll agree. So you say provide foo var, And you say require M1 to import M1 and M2. Scheme 48, finally, the thing is not called module anymore, it's called structure. So we've got something called define structure, which defines something called M1, but again, there's the export keyword, which says what identifiers are exported. Like MZ scheme, scheme 48 is explicit about importing the base language. And you need to explicitly declare when your actual code starts. So you'll see that they're superficially all very similar. However, so one important difference that you can see, and it's very difficult to relate that difference to specific requirements that you might have in your module system, is, well, you have this module language. It has parentheses, like the rest of Lisp or Scheme. So, but does it really live in the same world? Is it subject to things like macro expansion, and how does it relate to things like compilation units and stuff like that? So, for example, in Biglu, there's a clear separation between the module language and the language of the bodies of the module. They can't nest or anything like that, and that boundary is the line that's up there in the picture. So, in Shay's scheme, again, we remember the syntax was superficially very similar, but in fact, modules are part of the regular language, so there's no boundary, right? The boundary is above it all. So you can have modules nested in local scopes and so on. You can have macros expanded to modules and all that kind of stuff. In this scheme, it's kind of strange because the module form itself is separate. It's in a separate language, but the import and the export form called require and provide, they are part of the sort of the base language, and they are subject to macro expansion. So the boundary is in a funny place. And in Scheme 48, the boundary is actually in the same place as with Biglu. So there's, again, a clear separation between the module language, all of the module language, including import and export, and the language of the body of the modules. And the reason for this difference is really, and this would be the subject of a couple of separate talks, is that people are doing different things with module systems. And it's very difficult after all these years and all the struggle to really talk about this rationally. So it's been a long, long process. So, but in the end, we just decided that we're just going to sit down and formulate a set of minimal requirements, and then we'll just have to ditch everything that's controversial and doesn't immediately contribute to fulfilling those requirements. And that actually worked pretty well. So we wanted the module system to be compatible with the hygiene of the macro system, and we wanted to be able to export macros. And that was pretty important to us. We wanted to have separate compilation. Very important to us because of that portability requirement was to be able to share code with others. Of course, we wanted namespace management, and we wanted explicit declaration of dependencies. And so the system that we end up with, at least as far as that boundary is concerned, looks mostly like Biglu's and Scheme 48 system. The other extensions that Ms. Scheme and Shay Scheme have that give you more power also come at the cost of possibly, you can just do some dangerous things, and we didn't feel that they contribute directly to those requirements. So maybe some future version of the standard will deal with that. But now you can write libraries, and the library system is actually quite powerful that's in the standard. So you can write a library called My helper is it stuff. It exports a procedure called findDupe. It imports the composite library, so it can use almost all the stuff in the standard. The definition isn't important. I didn't list on the list of highlights, I didn't list square brackets. Maybe it should have been on there. So we've got square brackets now. So here's one library. We can then define another library that uses the findDupe procedure from the previous slide in the definition of a macro, of a procedural macro. So we've got syntax case now, which allows you to write scheme code that actually performs the expansion. And what you have to say is, you have to say, well, I want the my helpers it stuff, I want to import it, but I want to use it in my macro. And so you've got to say, I want to use it for expand. And so we've got a phase separation in the library system, which allows you to have separate compilation and have the system, and enable the system to figure things automatically. And then of course you can import both the original helper library, and you can also import the macro, the library that defines the macro from the previous slide, just use it. Right? That's pretty neat, I feel, anyway. So, there's the libraries. So here's something that was not very contentious among the editors when we designed it. So R5RS doesn't even give you ASCII. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it defines its own character set. And so we really wanted to have some portable way to deal with text. And the obvious choice is to do something with Unicode, whatever that something is. So when we looked at Unicode, well, there's two aspects. And the thing is, if you want to deal with Unicode text, you really need to know a little bit about how Unicode is structured. There's not really a way around that. So Unicode, there's two aspects to it. There's a semantic model of Unicode, which says, well, you know, your text is going to be essentially a sequence of numbers, and those numbers, each of those numbers, has a separate semantics, and there's all kinds of tables that the Unicode consortium ships that tells you bits of semantic information about each of these numbers. And then there's encodings of these sequences of numbers. And these numbers that I was talking about just before are called Unicode scalar values, and then there's different encodings that tell you how to represent those sequences of numbers as sequences of bytes. So there's UTF-8, which uses 8-bit coding units. There's UTF-16, which uses 16-bit coding units, encoded either big endian or little endian, and the same thing for UTF-32, and there's like a half dozen others. So we decided early on that we really wanted the semantic model and that we didn't want a representation based on one of the encodings. And if you know Java or C# or the Windows APIs or ICU or any of those, most of those use text representations based on the UTF-16 encodings. And so it's easy to get confused because the code units of UTF-16, they fill that little hole in those. I mean, there's a little thing where it says surrogates. There's a certain range in those numbers that are reserved for use as code units in UTF-16. So we made a very conscious decision, since these are artifacts of a specific encoding, that we were going to exclude those. So text, a character in Scheme, is really one of these semantic things in Unicode. It's a scalar value, and it supports a number of semantic operations. It's this a lowercase character, uppercase character, and so on, which, if we included the surrogates, wouldn't have been true, because you might be holding only half of one of them. And we felt that if we were to use a UTF-16-based encoding, that would be sort of the same thing as saying, well, we're just going to use GIF as the internal encoding of images, and then you know your application is going to have to do its own decompression, compression, and operation on the various things. It's maybe not quite so extreme, but of course, all these other languages and operating systems and platforms, I think mostly because they standardized much earlier on Unicode, when space requirements were different from what they are now, is they standardized on UTF-16. And so we're right now, you can still jump in the, you know, there's a thread going on, which is right now right here, I believe, which where people would like to see some sort of provision to also include the UTF-16 surrogates, or to have generally UTF-16 or UTF-8 or agnostic or whatnot representation of text. But we really wanted things to be portable. We wanted to be semantically sensible. And so that was a clear-cut decision, I believe, among the editors. But some of the community disagree. So that's still interesting. I don't think we'll change that decision. But it's sort of interesting to look at the process. And we have, so Scheme 48 and PLT Scheme have implemented the model that will be in the standard for a number of years now. Our experience with it is quite good. That's also one of the reasons why it's unlikely to change. So there's that. So I talked a little bit about the portability, about the records, about the libraries, about the Unicode. As I said, there's all kinds of other aspects, and there's many, many changes that we made to the language. And I encourage you to look at the standard, and if there's anything that bugs you, or if you find a mistake, to either post to the discussion list or post a formal comment. So right now we're in public review, so everybody can look at what we've got. Everybody can submit what we call a formal comment, where the editors are required to give a formal response. That period is formally over, but I think if important formal comments come in, we'll still answer them. So the editors have committed themselves to publish responses to the currently outstanding batch of formal comments by April 15th, and we'll have, I think there's about 70 or 80 left, so we still have some work to do to make all these decisions that have to do with the formal comments. Then hopefully we'll have another revision, another draft revision of the standard. It might appear on May 15th, as I'm the one who has to do the typing. I suspect it'll be a little bit later. A little bit later, we'll also have non-normative appendices and rationale. So my guess is that we'll be done with all of this at the end of June, so not so far in the future. So there's the editors' committee. We also have a steering committee that is in charge of making sure that everything goes smoothly. And they're also organizing a ratification procedure, which gives the community a chance to vote into this, to buy into the standard by voting on it if they have a stake. So if you don't have a stake in Scheme yet, you know, acquire one, and make sure that you apply for taking part in the ratification process. And you can read all about it again at r6rs.org. So, conclusions. Many, 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 many changes. I don't think anybody's counted, but there's certainly hundreds of decisions that we made. There's substantial subsystems where we made new designs or adopted old designs that have been around for a long time. I think R6RS will really, hopefully, greatly improve the situation with portability. Right now, any substantial scheme program is not portable. And hopefully we'll start seeing more portable scheme programs, and also to have the infrastructure required to talk about what makes a program portable or not and what its requirements are. It's much bigger. John pointed out the last revision of the standard R5RS was 50 pages. The first part of the new standard is now around 70 or 80 pages, I believe, mostly because the formal semantics is longer and because it includes a description of the library system, which wasn't in R5RS at all, and because there are many little imprecisions in R5RS that we clarified and that we caught. So, but it just about corresponds to R5RS, and the library report is around another 70, 75 pages. So it's about tripled in size total. But of course, compared to 1,400 pages, we're still doing good. Hopefully I was able to demonstrate with the four highlights that I explained. I don't think we would have been able to make substantial progress on any of them if we had still gone with the unanimous consent rule that was in place up until R5RS. I don't think any of these decisions were unanimous, and it would have been very, very difficult to make progress. And I think R5RS, after 3 years working on R6RS, I think it was very good up until R5RS, because really many of the decisions that led to R5RS were very, very good, but that's just about the limit. I don't think anything beyond that would have been possible, anything substantial. So I would like to encourage you to ratify, because I think what we have is pretty good, but I would rather see you vote no in the ratification than not seeing you take part at all. So please get involved. Thank you very much. So R5RS only gives you a very limited form of textual. First of all, it's only textual, and the notion of text is largely undefined. most of all, we wanted binary I.O. to add binary I.O. to the mix. And of course, as we now have Unicode for the textual representation at the I.O. level, we really need to deal with all these different encodings. And also, we want to be, if you do open output file with R5RS on a file that exists, there's no way to tell what happens, right? On some scheme systems, it'll fail. On some scheme systems, it'll silently overwrite the old file. And so we wanted to pin down all those little, not quite all of them, but a lot of those little corners.
Similarly to the modules, could you give us a bit of a flavor of the syntax case that one, did you sort of get the EMZ scheme all seen or dancing 43 million options, or the Shay scheme, but kind of, what was the flavor of the syntax case that it came up?
It's somewhere in the middle. So as far as the features that are in the system are concerned, it's pretty minimal for a syntax case. The important thing, maybe that's interesting for the column lispers, is one of the questions that we had a debate was whether the intermediate representation, how close it was going to be to S expressions, right? Whether compound syntactic forms would be represented as lists, or whether they would have separate, whether there would be a separate opaque data type. And so right now there is a separate opaque data type in the system that will get decomposed by the pattern matcher and syntax case to lists. But with MC scheme, which has all sorts of little features that allow you to pop up and pop down in levels and that syntax certificates and all that. So we really, the stuff that's in there is pretty much the stuff that we all agree is useful in a lot of programs. And for the rest, I think even Matthew Flatt, for a lot of that stuff, he felt that more experimentation and more research on how important it all is really needed. I think there's a general feeling that there's creeping featureism in the system. But one thing that all this stuff has led to is that people have started, again, to more seriously think about ways to design macro systems. We're, after 10 years, we're... Everybody thought, the syntax case, that's sort of the end of it. We're now seeing new designs, and that's very cool.
John?
Yes?
At the end of the 8 years of standardization of the common list, there were some things that were left unstandardized because we recognized they were hard problems, they were important problems, that there wasn't time to solve them with given the time left in the universe, so we didn't try them. But there were other things that were very so useful, they deserved to be standardized, but it was impossible because of the ferment. Continuing ferment, non-ending ferment in the styles of window systems, def systems, the equivalent of Unix make, multitasking principles, foreign function interfaces, a whole bunch of those were left as substandards and they have not progressed over that time. Is there anything like that in the scheme world? Things that seem to be inherently unstable and not standardizable in the foreseeable future?
Well, so one thing, of course, we didn't standardize, except that people asked of us, was to standardize on some form of concurrency. That's an area clearly where there's a lot of active. I mean, for the longest time, everybody felt, either message passing or shared memory with locks or some other form of mutual exclusion. And we're now seeing all this interesting research in hardware design with transactional memory. So that's I think an issue. So I think it'll be better. It will have a much higher quality design for this kind of thing at some point. Possibly in the near future than we could have now. And I'm pretty confident that we'll make progress on that. The neat thing is that we've got the Cerfi process that I think is going to be an important complement to the standardization process, and that has served as an incubator for many of the same things that are in R6 or S. I don't think there's that many of them that we replicated exactly, but they were very important in the sense that that there was some kind of precedent there that we could look at, and also that what's very important about the survey is that there's archive discussion, which is, for the longest time, the official mailing list of the authors, the archives weren't universally accessible, and now there's so much of it, and it's so far in the past, it's very hard to dig it up again. With the surveys, at least it's pretty easy to categorize. And so I feel that we've got right about the right mechanism to serve as an incubator for future things like threads or for maybe even a window system. I think that's further in the future for various reasons. I think the sense among all of us editors was that we hope that it will be a more continuous process from now on, that there won't be this gap, which also interrupted the process. It would have been very hard to restart the original process. And I certainly hope that the next that R7RS, the process, will start in the very near future.
So does that mean instead of unanimity, you're going more standard of what ANSI has been expecting in the past, a kind of a committee with a vote and a reaffirm and
yes.
So on?
Yes, yeah. We've copied many of the general structures that are, I'm actually not that familiar with formal standards.
Organizational structures, I guess is what
the it organizational is. Structures, yeah. But some of the other members, like Will Klinger, who's also been involved with columnists, have contributed quite a bit of that.
That's part from my question. What is the future of surface?
It'll just go on as before.
Does go on as before.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So maybe we'll do something with XML, but.
So, how much support are you getting from the implementers?
Well, so there's a bunch of implementers that are editors, like Scheme 48, Chase Scheme, PLT Scheme, and Larceny are all represented on the editors committee. It's hard to tell, and that's an interesting, very tricky question, and we'll get more answers, I think, when the ratification happens. It was already a problem with R5RS, right? Even though, in theory, implementers could have started implementing R5RS in 92, right? But some implementations still didn't support R5RS, you know, after the 90s. So, so I fully expect. I mean, and R6RS in many, many ways is much harder to implement just because there's more stuff and because there's more overlap with the extensions that individual scheme systems have, where implementers might feel strongly about the stuff that they have as opposed to what we offer. So, so I'm pretty optimistic that we'll get a half dozen high quality implementations. But I'm also pretty confident that there's going to be a lot of implementations that are still going to do active research or have some other focus that isn't primarily on standardization or portability that find their own niches and that don't implement all the standard. But I can only speculate and hope at this point. Yes?
What were the square brackets that you said you wish you'd mentioned?
Well, so the square brackets are just the same as the round brackets.
Oh,
right? Mm-hmm. So they're noise, you might say. They're completely redundant. But I think, some scheme systems have had them for the longest time, and they're a bear to eliminate from a piece of code that somebody sends you, so there was precedent for it. I think some of us felt that even though not all of us use it ourselves, so my personal experience, I don't use them square brackets, but I found that in teaching beginners, it's sometimes beneficial to give them a little bit more visual variety to hold on to. That might sound banal, but it's helped me teach students. And so that was one of the reasons, I think, why we added it.
The square brackets, a closing square bracket doesn't have any semantics like it ensures that you've closed all your in or round brackets?
No. I mean, a square bracket has to be closed with a square bracket. That's all there is to it. So you can distinguish it that way. But a pair of square brackets is the exact same thing as a pair of round brackets.
What I'm saying is if you have an open square bracket, two open round brackets, one closing round bracket, and then a closing square bracket, do they have to be
matched up. So the square brackets have to match those square brackets.
It's one less key press.
I'm sorry?
Square brackets are one less key press. You don't have to use shift.
Depending on your keyboard layout.
Yeah. I've had a use for such a thing. It doesn't exist in Common Lisp, but some of the most inscrutable code to read is the use of double back quotes. Double back quotes common. Just some way to designate where the macro generated code stops and your program begins again. When there's 16 closing right parentheses, that would have helped sometimes to have a square bracket balancing it out in there.
So I could throw another one in. Case sensitivity. Also very
Does R6RS remain in any way, according to in your own opinion, compatible with the original design goals of Scheme?
Yeah.
Or does it not matter? Or have you heard of schemers that for instance, would be horrified by the way things are turning out and would rather stick to fifth revision?
I'm very sure there's people who are horrified, but so again, that's very, I mean, the thing is, again, if you look at the report, I only listed the new goals, but there's also a list of old goals, which we extracted from previous versions, which don't have an explicit list. But it's very difficult to interpret some of that stuff, right? One of the most important things you might argue with R5RS that says, well, we don't want to pile feature upon feature. But as it turns out, if you talk to people, that means different things to different people. And you might argue that even in R5RS, there's too much stuff piled on other stuff. Maybe if you can reduce the amount of that. I mean, we certainly,
we've tried very, very hard to sort of meet the to meet the goals that we extracted from the previous rounds. And I feel that we've done pretty well, but I'm sure others will disagree. But the goals are listed in there. So if you really feel you've got a good argument to make that we've disregarded one of the goals that it lists, then you can probably make a case. And that's bound to figure strongly in the discussions that we have. And it always does.
Okay. Christoph? So you mentioned Unicode.
Yes.
And since you asked about, since you mentioned case sensitivity as well, can you use Unicode in programmed text as opposed to just string?
Yes.
So then your processor, you load or whatever, has to know about the encoding.
Yes.
Are you sensitive to normalization forms?
No.
So
that's that's one of the areas where the report proper doesn't really say very much. It just tells you, oh, your program is Unicode text in some form, and the non-normative dependencies talk a little bit. And I'll leave, there's a little bit about normalization when they come out. Just because, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, right? There's some encodings now, but new ones get invented, you know, IDNA or something like that. So there might be different ways to, that's a detail that we didn't want to standardize right now. But the non-normative dependencies will definitely talk about the encoding if you actually distribute code.
Maybe the last question.
To some degree, standards processes are prescriptive, telling the vendors that you better do it this way or else we'll stop using your product. Mm-hmm. To some degrees, they're descriptive, that is, they're looking like a dictionary that's writing what people do rather than what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see that tension in the current standardization efforts?
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, it sort of, again, a lot of us aren't that familiar with this sort of, with sort of the usual tenets of standardization, so it's something that I never thought about until a couple months ago, anyway. So it's pretty prescriptive in many ways. So one thing where that was important is that there's a difference between the requirements you have of the programmer and the requirements you have of the implementer or of the implementation. And sometimes they're synonymous in that you say, well, you know, the argument to this procedure has to be, you know, that type. But with mutable lists, for example, and higher order procedures, you can't enforce that, right? So you can't require the implementation to actually check that that requirement is fulfilled. So that type safety thing is actually a pretty intricate issue that I mentioned earlier. And so in those cases, again, it's prescriptive. So the report really says in many places where R5RS just said, this is an error, right? Which meant that it's unspecified, right? The programmer might do something, the implementation might do something, they might match or not. But now there's really a difference where that diverges. It really explicitly says the programmer's responsibilities are such and such. You've got to provide arguments that look like this. And then it separately specifies the requirements the things that the implementation actually has to check of those requirements. So, but it's prescriptive, I would say.
That's one of the reasons Cobblers grew so big, because people were doing things, and we decided that as long as they're doing them, they should do them all the same way. That was better than having them proliferate needlessly.
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases we decided to sort of. So for example, you might have some procedure that, map, right? Map you can apply to a variable number of lists, right? And sort of for the operation makes sense, you really want them all to be the same length, but of course, some implementations make sense even if they aren't. And so there's many of those examples. And basically, as far as the program is concerned, we're prescriptive in the sense that they really have to be all the same length. But the implementation is required in all of those cases to actually check that. So, but we really decided that we're, even though there's common usage in that sort of direction, if it wasn't obvious what the semantics are, it's not in there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike.